where you're born and everything like that and everything like that. So
you asked the question then.
Yes, sir. And you, if you want to go off on something else, just go ahead. This is perfectly fine for this. This is Josh Moore interviewing Mr. Henry Graves, World War II POW, and for the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. Mr., what is your full name?
Henry W. Graves.
Gotcha. Where were you born at?
I was born in Lakeview, Maine, in 1918. October 4th.
Gotcha. Were any of your family members when you were growing up, were they in the military?
Say again?
Were any of your family members in the military when you were growing up?
When I was growing up, my brother-in-laws both was in, had just come out of World War I. Two brothers-in-laws. They married my sisters, and that's the only experience I had with the war, as far as I know. And then before the war, I was in the the airplanes were searching out in the ocean.
Coast Guard?
No. Civil Air Patrol.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I was in the Civil Air Patrol. I was a mechanic observer. We had an Army officer that took care of charge of us, and we had every week we had training and lessons and everything, and then on weekends we flew over to the coast, and we spent one day out over the ocean looking for submarines. That's in 1941 or 1942, right the first part of the war.
Yeah.
1942 and 1943, I think, that happened. And that's when I got drafted. I thought I probably could get in the Air Force, either go pilot or mechanic at least, because I had a mechanic thing already. But they didn't take me. They said they had too many people that fell down from the top and took them places. And I ended up in the infantry. And I went to Massachusetts when I got drafted, and then they put us on a train. I ended up in Anniston, Alabama to take basic training. I was married at the time, had one child, my wife was pregnant with another one, and I had a hernia, and they still drafted me. So when I got down to Alabama and was doing real rough training, it ruptured on me. Went in, swelled up. When I woke up, I was in the hospital with my legs up. I spent 42 days in the hospital over Christmas. And then when I got back on duty again, they made me take it all over again, the training. How far do you want me to go before you change anything?
Keep going.
Okay. So then I took my training all over again, and they sent me home for 30 days. And then I went to New Jersey. They put me in a boat across to New York and put us on the Mauritania, which was the second largest cruise ship at that time. Mm-hmm. Queen Mary was the first and Mauritania was the second. And we took 7 days going across with no escort or anything, just room. And we landed in Scotland. And then they put us on trains and they took us to southern England as a replacement camp. At this point, I'm a replacement all the time. Now, I don't remember how long I was there or anything, but it was after D-Day. And then in I think it was August, later August, they sent me across to Omaha Beach as a replacement, bunch of us. And they put us up on there and put us in a pup tent so we had to live in, and made us work to cleaning up the beach and loading trucks with gas and stuff. For over a month or so it was. Then finally, my division here landed in Cherbourg. They're the first division that came over by ship and landed right in France. So they sent me over there as a replacement for them. And then they was there for, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks because the Germans was offshore. They had a whole army there, and we was protecting from the Germans to come ashore. They was out on an island. Finally, the division, we had to walk about 50 miles, and then they put us on freight cars. And they took us all the way across France over to Belgium. And then they gave us to the Canadian Army. Mm-hmm. Why, I don't know. But anyway, we had to replace some British soldiers because they was trying to take the Germans out of Antwerp so they could bring ships in with supplies. That's all in there. And we did. I didn't fight. I was still a replacement. But my company fought all the way through Belgium and Holland, crossed the river. Then they loaded us on trucks, took us around, and dropped us in Germany at outside of Aachen, Germany. Then I joined the company at that point as a fighting man. All this time, though, I'd been under artillery fire all this time because they kept us close to the front for replacement purposes. Then that was just hell from then on in. For 28 days, I think it was, roughly, I was in right in the front lines in foxholes. And all the praying I could ever say is that God protect me so I can get home to my wife and kids. Because my daughter had been gone, meanwhile, so I had 2 children now. So we had to fight up through the German I can't say things.
Yeah.
We had to fight through these pillboxes on the border. Siegfried Line, there it is. This is the Siegfried Line. We had to fight through there. And I mean, this was hell every day. Some days you'd sit in your foxhole and be 60 shells a minute coming over. Or screaming memes, they call them, with big shells with going over. But thank God they usually went over us because they was after the ammunition, the trucks behind us. So we fought here, and then on the Thanksgiving Day, we was going to be relieved to go to Paris for a 3-day thing. Mm-hmm. Well, that night they decided that the description's in here, Hill 272. I think I may find it. Yeah, I get it. Hill 272. They decided that these towns that we was attacking all the time, the Germans had trenches all around them for the defense. And this hill here had trenches all around this town. And my platoon was ordered to take that hill that morning. They said it was Germans all over the place. Well, we had an attack to start at 4 o'clock, which we usually did in the dark. Mm-hmm. Well, the rolling barrage come, was supposed to go ahead of us. It hit behind us. It killed a captain and a lieutenant and the artillery man. Confusion. And I don't know now, daylight was breaking, but we finally started. And my job with my squad was, I was first scout. Today they call them the point man, but my day was scouting, and I was a head man, and so I was out ahead, and we crawled up this thing with firing guns all the time at the top. We probably shot 40, 50 rounds of ammunition to keep them down. But when I got there, there wasn't nobody there. What had happened was, they saw the confusion we had down there. They backed off and lit us up there, but they had it all zeroed in. So when I got up there, I saw it was empty, so I motioned for my squad to come up and the platoon to come up, which is, I don't know, 30 so men. So they come up and get in, and then the sergeant come to me and he says, Henry, you go down the hill towards that factory to see if we can draw fire, see where they are. So I started down the hill. And I was about halfway down, and all these black puffs was going off, which I'd never seen before. I found out later they were shooting at me with AK guns. And these puffs was explosions. So I jumped in a shell hole. And of course, all the time, now the mud is this deep. Mud and rain, and oh, it's terrible. So I jumped in this foxhole. And I looked up and I looked down at that factory and it looked like ants coming out, thousands of soldiers coming out of there, coming at us. Meanwhile, they'd opened up and started mortars and artillery on top of the hill, killing my boys up there. But I wanted to be with them, so I took my gold shoes off because it was so darn heavy so I could run, because I was about 200 yards ahead of them. So I got my overshoes off, and I dumped everything I had except my ammunition. I had a belt and four hand grenades, and my rifle, of course. And I took off of that top of that hill, and there was everything coming, bullets coming around me, and everything going on. So I got in this thing, and I jumped in the thing, and I see all the boys, half of them were dead already. So I took my shovel and dug in the bank on the side of the inside of the trench so I could get away from the mortars coming down. And then I got up, and then I started firing out these guys coming. I probably shot 40 or 50 rounds, and my rifle jammed. Couldn't shoot no more, because I had about 160 rounds I could have shot. So then I walked down the trench, see if I could find any guys, and I found two or three guys alive. And I said, come back to me, we'll take a stand right here. And about that time, we heard tanks coming, one on our right side and one on our left side. And meanwhile, these guys were close enough, we started to throw our hand grenades at them. And then, last thing I remember, it was nothing. Something blew me up. When I come to, I got a big wound up here. That's it. And I was peppered with that stuff.
Shrapnel.
And I'm walking down the highway holding a ladder that had wounded Germans on it. And there was no more GIs, just me. The others were all Germans. And we're going down this superhighway because we was fighting on this big superhighway. We was fighting to the right of it from there to Cologne. That was our objective. And then finally, I had a terrible headache and I can't remember hardly anything. But when I remember, the next thing I remember, I'm in a cellar, and a guy's interviewing me, asking me questions, and he knew more about my company than I knew. I couldn't figure that out. And then he took all my clothes away, which was against all rules and regulations. My watch, my thing, everything. And in my pocket, I had I'll show it to you so you'll understand what I'm talking about. Yeah, right there. And a New Testament Bible. It had a metal cover on it. My mother had given one when I went. And They took that, of course, and gave me these old threadbare clothes and some shoes with wooden soles on them. It made me work in a bakery at this little town we was in. Now, here again, I don't know how long I was there, but after a few days, maybe, or I don't know how long, really, but it was before Christmas, because once they come and pick me up one night, in the truck that they picked me up in was loaded with GIs like me, only I didn't know any of them. They was all from other outfits. And they put me in this truck, and this is dead of night now. And every time they'd come to a crossroad, they'd have to wait till the shelling, because Americans are shelling those crossroads. So they'd have to wait until they said, and then we'd duck through. Took us all the way to Rhine River, and the bridge was blown over Rhine River, but they made us crawl across on the steel to the other side. And then they got us in, there was about, I'm 40 or 50 of us by now. I don't know how many really. But we was quite a group, and they had two Germans on bicycles guarding us. And they made us walk. And I don't know how far we walked, but it was a couple weeks before Christmas, because when we got to the end of the place, it was a town called Limburg, which was a collecting place where they was taking all the GIs they had captured on the Battle of the Bulge, because I was captured a month before that. They threw me in there with them in this big barn. And of course, I'm still having headaches, and I'm tired and hungry, discouraged. And I looked down across the room, and I saw this blonde-headed fellow with a khaki suit, jumper suit, come out of the door, and he walked right through everybody. He come up to me, and he handed me back that Bible. And, of course, I went all to pieces. I went quick, because I had my wife's picture with the children in there that she'd sent me when I was in England. So I hunted for it, and I found it. And, of course, I'd all gone to pieces to be there. And I looked up. I didn't see him. I asked the guy sitting inside him. I said, where'd that fella go? What fella? Nobody saw him.
That's cool.
Now, that guy had been with me for all the time I was fighting, because I never got hit until that time I got blown up. I had bullets in my clothes, the pant legs. I had my overcoat shot the ass off with the shrapnel. And it should have killed me a long time ago, but nothing ever touched me until that day that I got blown up. What blew me up, I don't know, the mortar shell or a big shell or one of those tanks fired, I don't know. So, all this time now, the only time, once in a while, they'd come by and give us a piece of bread or a piece of cheese. That's all we was eating. We was hungry, 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 and thirsty. Well, within the 2 or 3 days, either just before Christmas or right after, I can't remember, they loaded us in boxcars in the rail yard there. There was probably 1,000 of us in these boxcars. And that night, the British bombers came over and dropped 30 ton of bombs on that rail yard. My car I was in blew over and broke open. And I crawled down underneath for safety as good as I could. And every time one of those bombs would go, it would hit you in the stomach and knock you out, you know. And here again, I didn't know this till 6 years after all, there was 500 of us killed that night, right there in that rail yard. Anyway, here again, I don't know how many days it was, they put us in this camp while they was pulling us together and gave us a little bit of something to eat. And then they loaded us back on freight cars again and hauled us all the way across Germany in a matter of 10 days. Without much to eat, had to do your duty in the corner of the car, locked us in, and then we got out to this place over they called it Stalag 4B, which somebody tells me that's where I was, but I never was stayed there. The only thing they did there to me is they gave me a shot and give me a German dog tag, which I got up there. They give me a German dog tag. And then they got a bunch of us together and they'd say, well, food is scarce, men. This camp is loaded. We got to move you out. We got a few destinations that if you like to work, we'll feed you better. One was a mine in a mountain, and then one was a railroad. I took the railroad because I knew a little bit about railroads from my experiences home. So they loaded 24 of us on a passenger car and hauled us over near that famous concentration camp.
Auschwitz?
Can't remember the name of it.
Auschwitz?
One of them, over in Poland, anyway.
Auschwitz.
And took us up in the mountain, and it was near the Russian front, and there was this big railroad yard with 10 locomotives in a roundhouse that was pushing the war over the mountains. So they put us there to work, and they put us in that roundhouse in a room to work. Well, at first all we had to do is go down underneath all those trains every day and pick the cinders up and load them on and get them out of there in a wheelbarrow. And then then when it snowed, they'd make us go out and clear the snow out of the switching things and things like that. And then we was there. Now we're in January, and I came from Maine, and that was twice as cold as Maine, and it snowed every day. Well, the first month they gave us pretty good food. We had potatoes and bread and a little cheese, and then it got a little pretty soon we only had soup with potatoes. Soup once a day and a piece of bread at night. That's all they gave us. And then it kept getting worse and worse and worse, and along about February, March, we would get, all we got was a turnip a day, a man, and a horse's head once in a while. We had a big iron, we got burned out of our roundhouse. The Russians come over and burnt that down. Bombed it. So they moved us up with the Russians. They had a lot of Russian prisoners there. So they moved us up in a hut near the Russians. There's a lot of details I could tell you, but it's just too much. So anyway, along about, I can't remember dates now, sometime when the war was over in May, I think. Well, before the war was over in May, they let us go out in the field and see if we could find something to eat. And all we could find was parsnip. If you want to know what a parsnip is, it ain't too appetizing. And then the Russians run over us. These Mongolian Russians with Tommy guns. And all the officers were women, Russian women, big, rugged ones. They just run over us, didn't bother us or nothing, just took off, left us. And then, of course, the Germans that was guiding us, they all took off ahead and left us there. And this is the 1st of June now. We didn't know where to go. Five guys had died that winter. I don't know what either pneumonia or something. The Germans took them off when they got sick, so I don't know what happened to them, really. But they died, I know. And, I lose my train of thought. Sorry.
Sorry.
Well, me and my buddy, That's my buddy right there, Joe Marino. This is me. There's a story about that thing. I'll tell you then.
Okay.
But we was walking south because we was up on this mountain. We figured better walking south, and it was beginning to get good and warm. And we'd walked, I don't know how many days, maybe one or maybe two, maybe three, I don't know. But then this German army come that was in Czechoslovakia, and they was trying to escape the Russians, because there was Russians all around, and they was coming down this road, and we're sitting side the road, and then the Russian airplanes come and strafed them. And we were right in the middle of it. But we couldn't do anything. What was left, left, and we were still sitting there. And here again, I don't know how many days we sat there, one or two maybe. But we're starving, we're trying to find something to eat with the dead people, but nobody had anything to eat. And so we was eating grass. And I looked up the road, and here comes a cow and a horse hauling a wagon, a little wagon. And this peasant was with him, an old man. We thought he was old, he probably wasn't that old. But anyway, he come up and we're hollering, "American, American, American," you know, because we didn't speak the language or anything. He come over to us, looked at us, didn't say a word in our language, but he said something, and he picked us up like babies and put us in that cart and took us to his home, which was a peasant thatch roof, dirt floor, with a shelf and a big fireplace. And his wife, which to us was an old lady, but she might not have been that old, but anyway, she put us in a big wooden tub and scrubbed us, because we was filthy. Same clothes we'd been wearing all winter. And then they put us up on a, their beds and everything was up on a shelf over the living quarter, because down here they got cows and horses all living together for the heat they get. And I remember somebody trying to pour something down my throat, but I don't remember what it was. And I don't know how long we was there. But eventually, my buddy and I was half awake, and we heard this girl hollering in a megaphone, "Any Americans around? Hunting for Americans. Or British," because there was a lot of Russians and everybody else around us, but they was hunting for us. So the old man come up and got us and got us down and got us out to this. She was a Czechoslovakian young girl. She loaded us onto a station, a pickup truck, and took us to a railroad station. I don't know how far, but she put us on a railroad car and took us to Prague, the Czechoslovakian capital. And when we got there, they put us in this barracks that the Germans had when they were fighting, they was living there. And in there was all these GIs, and not many GIs, but mostly British and Russians, all prisoners. And they was feeding us potato soup because they didn't dare to give us anything else, kill us. And then this British doctor that was one of the British men that we were prisoners, he examined us and they put us to bed, me and my buddy, because we were so weak we could hardly do anything. Well, and I don't know how long we was there, but pretty soon we got so we could walk and got our feet going. And so one Sunday we wanted to get out and look, and they let us go out. So we went out, walked down the street. And we was going by this church, it looked like a big cathedral, and we could hear English singing in there. So all us, these was a South African and an English fella, besides me and my buddy. But in the church, we sat in the back seat, bellowing our heads off. And this little old lady sat ahead of us. And when the church was over, she turned around to us. She said, "How would you boys like to have a chicken dinner?" Can you imagine? Because we'd been having potato soup. So they took us into the rectory where this guy was the pastor. She took us in and they fed us a beautiful chicken dinner, the whole five of us. And then they took this picture. And I got this picture, I don't know, 6 or 8 months after all was over, I got this picture back home with a note telling me what this place was and everything. And I tried to correspond with them. But by then, the Russians had taken over Czechoslovakia. And I never got into contact with them again. And nothing ever went through. My letters never came back, but I didn't hear from them either. So, meanwhile, I had my Bible, and all the time during this prisoner of war camp, Sundays we didn't have to work. So I had all my men. Oh, by the way, the Germans made me the boss of the place. I don't know why. I had glasses on. Maybe that's why. Nobody else. Well, I was the oldest, come to think of it. That's a fact I forgot to tell. Mm-hmm. When I joined my outfit here, all these kids was 18, 19 years old. I'm 23 at the time. They called me Pappy. I was Pappy. And that's why they made me a scout out front, too. The captain of the division talked to me one day. He said, "You come from Maine, man, huh?" "I said, yep." He said, "You do a lot of hunting?" "Oh, yeah. Hunting always my life." He said, "Good. We need you out front." So they made me point man. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah, we was in Prague, the capital of Czechoslovakia. And after, here again, I don't know how long we was there. Month, maybe a month and a half. It was, the war had been over for 2 months. That's how long we'd been there. Mm-hmm. Finally, that same girl come back. She said, "All Americans in here, they can climb on that truck. How they get on?" So there was about 25, I think, of us. And it's just a pickup truck. And I mean, we was all over the place. She said, "We're going down the road to the Russian checkpoint, and the Americans are about 20 miles away. We got to go through this Russian checkpoint, and I'll take you there." So when I get to that checkpoint, he says, "You guys just be quiet, don't say anything." And I'm going in. So she did. We could see her in there, her hands going, talking to the Russians. She finally come out and she says, "Hang on." She said, "I don't know if they're going to shoot us or not, but we're going down the road." So down the road we went. And we must have gone, I don't know, half a day before we got to the Americans. And the minute we got to the Americans, they immediately took us in, stripped all the clothes, because the Red Cross had stripped those clothes off us when they picked us up and gave us some used clothes, but they was almost GI clothes. As you can see the picture, see, they look like GI clothes, mm-hmm. And gave me a pair of boots just like I had when I was fighting. But they took them all away, the Americans got me, gave me new clothes, put us through showers and DDT'd us and everything, and gave me a big pill about that big. And then they loaded us on airplanes. I went in a cornfield. They were bringing in food to the division. I don't know what division it was, but whatever. Well, they was bringing in food, and when they emptied, they said, "Okay, you guys line up. We're gonna put you on that plane." And I can see the captain now of the plane. He's standing by the door. We're getting on. "Oh, that's it," he said, "no more." He said, "I gotta load and I gotta take off in this cornfield." So he took off, and he was nice. All on the way across Germany, he went to all the big cities. He tipped the plane so we could see down and see all the things. And then they landed me in France. I don't know where. All I remember is they put me in a hospital and they gave me soups again and pills, all kinds of pills. And then I don't remember how long I was there. I don't remember getting on a ship. The next thing I remember, I'm standing on a dock in Norfolk, Virginia, with a very big tag around my neck. They tell me I was on a hospital ship, but I don't know. I never was conscious at all of the fact. So I'm standing on the dock, and pretty soon It was either a WAC or a Red Cross girl. I don't know which, because they both had the same uniform. She come and she had a one of these with the things in it. She said, "Here's your traveling things." She said, "I'm going to take you over to the railroad station and put you on a train." "How do you know where I'm going?" "Oh," she said, "I know where you're going. The others are in here." So anyway, they put me on a train. I don't remember going home until I got to my hometown. And here's my wife and my kids and my mother-in-law and my mother and father and all the town people were there. Because previous to this, I run a big company. And I knew everybody and everybody knew me. But I was pretty out of it. So anyway, when I got home, I still had this thing. Finally, my wife got into it. I had 90 days, and I had to report back to New York at Olympic Village up in New York, where they were giving us R&R, they called it, rest, and they was going to question us. Here, I don't remember the guy that interviewed me, like you. I don't remember what he said or what he asked me. And from there, they sent me to Camp Edwards in Massachusetts to the hospital again. They had to fix my teeth and give me some new glasses, and I was deaf and a doornail even then from when I was blown up. That came and go for 40 years. A little better, a little work. And then 15, 20 years ago, it got so bad I can't hear nothing, even with the hearing aids. So, where am I? I got home. And I got a call from my original boss, wanted to know when I could come back to work. And I said, "Well," I said, "I don't quite know what's going on, and I won't for a while, probably." I said, "We'll have to wait till after the first year." He said, "Well, I need you bad, Henry." Because I'd worked for them. I went to work for them in 1938. I graduated from high school in 37. I went to work for them. I worked for them up until I got drafted. I went from truck driver to assistant manager of one outlet. At that time, they had two outlets. So anyway, I went to work for them. This is the depression then. There was no jobs anywhere. I was walking down the street one day, and this guy was fixing a store. He said, "Can you push a wheelbarrow?" I said, "Yes, sir, I can." So he took me in. I pushed a wheelbarrow. They're cleaning out this building. And after about a month of working cleaning there, he looked at me and he said, "How'd you like to learn the plumbing and heat business?" I said, "Man, I'll do anything. I don't care what it costs or how much you pay me even. I want it." So I went to work for him when they get the place finished. It was a building, a new place. So I worked up from truck driver to stock man and receiving and all, every job in the place, until I was assistant manager of that outfit right there. Now when I come back, and I went back, they said, "Henry, we need you to go to Lewiston, Maine," which is a town 60 miles away. "I need to open up a new wholesale department. I need to build a warehouse." And he says, "I'm sure you can do it." I said, "Well, I never done it, but I know I can do it because I was good at that." So I went back. And I started in there working. And then the VA come after me and want to know if I want to go to college or take on-job training. So I went on-job, because I had a good job with these people for all these years. So I took on-job training, which they did it. This owner and the manager of that, where I was, took over. And I moved over there and bought a house, lived there for 4 or 5 years, I guess. And then they sent me back to my original place as manager and assistant vice president in charge of operations. I started buying stuff for all those stores. And then they made a little more, and they wanted to open up two more places. So I opened up two more places. Then they sold the company to a big Tally industry, which was a 500 company at that time. And the minute they got a hold of me, they made me president of the company. Because the people I owed was two Jewish boys, very good boys. They taught me everything. But they sold it out. And so the company made me president of the whole thing. But now I had six places and 300 employees, which I worked for 42 more years until 1979. They wanted to change the way we was doing business. And I said, you can't do that. We're up here in Maine. We have to. I had $7 million worth of inventory. They wanted me to operate it on two. I said, you can't do it. Because my lead time on manufactured goods, some of it is 8, 9, 10 months. I said, you can't do that. Because my big customers were pulp and paper mills. I had valves that went for $4,000 or $5,000, you know, things like that. Anyway, I quit. And they put me on half salary for 2 years. I couldn't believe it. I said, good. I said, I bought a condo back in the 70s down in North Palm Beach, Florida, and I'll move right down there. Oh, no. Well, I will. I said, I'm going to, just soon as I get out of here. And they said, well, we want you to be able to fly wherever we want you to go. Because I was helping them build places up there. Because me and my brother both worked there. And both of us we knew building and engineering and all that stuff. Electrical. So anyway, I had a good job. Now, where am I? So after the 79, I moved in a condo down in North Palm Beach, Florida. That was in 79. Now, all this time, I had never talked about the war. Nobody knew anything at all except I was a POW. That's all they knew. They knew nothing about it. In fact, I didn't know all these details myself. I didn't know what was going on around me, and neither did anybody else. When we was fighting, all we knew was who that guy was over there and who you're supposed to be careful guy on that side. There was a 30th Division on our left, and they was on the other side of that road, and we was on this side. So we had to be careful to move together so we didn't shoot each other. So, as I said, in 1979, I retired, and I went down there, and then I started having problems. Because during the war, I had frozen my feet, and and I had bad toes then, frostbite there. And then after a prisoner war, I had it again. And my hands, I can't make a fist, see? And so I was having trouble. And then my urinary blocked up on me, and they had to tooth me out. So my son here, he was in the Air Force for 5 years, and then he got hurt. And he was working in the VA here in Janesville. And I was complaining one day, I said, God, that insurance has cost me never. I said, Medicare's this, my extra. He said, what are you buying insurance for? I said, what am I going to do? He said, you're supposed to have everything free. I said, nobody ever told me that. Because I never went to the VA, only once. When I got home, they sent me, because when I got discharged, this knee, this leg, I got no feeling, even today, on the skin, no feeling. And they examined me and they gave me a 10% compensation or disability, 20%. And then I get moved 60 miles away, and I never went back to the VA. And then after 2 to 3 years, after I took that on-job training, they dropped my 20 down to 10. And I didn't say anything, because I didn't need it. I had a good job and everything. So when my son said, you got everything? I said, what do you mean I got everything? He said, all POWs get all everything free. All your doctors, medicine, everything. Pooh, he says, get you over to the clinic and where I was and get registered, which I did. And once I got registered, they took care of me good. fix me my teeth all up again and everything, get my hearing aids. And then I started to go to part. And I had to have some operations. And my son says, well, we better move you up to Gainesville from where I was down there, because I did down there, I had to go clean to Miami to go to hospital. Because there wasn't any hospital there. There is now, but there wasn't then. So I said, okay, we'll do. I said, where am I going to live? He said, well, they're building a new I was playing golf at the time. He said, they got a new Middlebrook being built out here with a golf course. I says, good, I'll come up and we'll go look. So I did, and I had them build me a apartment there, you know, they're all together. And I bought one, I don't know, 80 some odd thousand at the time. And so I moved up. And then the VA there took me in and gave me a hospital. They gave me a doctor, or they put me in what they call primary care one, which is because I was a disabled and a POW. But I still didn't know what I could get or have. And I was in getting operated on one day, and then one of a DAV man come in, and he started talking to me. He says, did you get your medals? I said, I don't even know what medals I got. I said, all they gave me was a little button when I got out of the Army. And they gave me my combat badge. I said, I don't know, and I never worried about it. I didn't care about it, because I never talked about it. So he says, well, we better find out. And he says, you're going to get 10% disability? Yeah, 10%, that all? He said, you should have 100%. I said, well, what do I do? He said, well, I'm going to take you over to St. Petersburg, where they talk to you about it and see if you can get it changed. So I went, but I couldn't prove anything. All my buddies was killed. They couldn't prove it. I couldn't prove I was wounded. So they disallowed it. So I went by another year and got talking about it again, and the DAV guy said, I'm going to take you over there again. We're going to go through this again. So we went over. They got a tape like you're doing, and he talked to me for an hour, and I told him a story like I've been telling you all along. But he says, do you know anybody? Can you get any proof of it? I said, no, of course I can. I don't know anybody. They're all dead. I said, I got operated on my leg afterwards, because when I got blown up, my leg got twisted. And it always came out of joint. And I said, back in, I think it was 60s, it locked. So I had to go get it operated, which I did. He says, can you get records of that? Well, he says, I don't know, it's been 50 years ago. Whether the doctor's still alive or not, I don't know. So I wrote a letter to Mass General where I had the work done. They couldn't find any records, and the doctor had died. So I told them that, and they said, well, we can't help you. So meanwhile, my DA man had died, and a lady took his place. And she called me, and I gave her the same letter. And I says, you got a stack of letters that high, all the things that I've talked about over at the VA thing. I said, go get those records, and you look at them, and then we'll talk about it, which she did. Oh, she says, you should have it easy. I said, well, they didn't give it to me. She said, well, I'm going to go over the heads, and I'm going to apply at the headquarters at Washington, which she did. And about 8 months later, I got a letter commanding those guys over there to do me over again and do it right, which they did. And this time, they put me through some x-rays, which they never had before. And the doctor with the x-ray, I kept telling him about this leg still numb. He says, that's funny. He says, I'm going to take you down to x-ray. So he did, and he shut me up. And I got the record in here. He says, He put the thing up on the wall. He said, there it is right there. And a little sliver, he says, about big's your thumbnail, but just sliver. It's up against your hip here. I said, what are we going to do about that? He said, don't do nothing. He says, it's all encapsulated now. It won't bother you. So there, I still got it. And I got that. I still got that. I had a lot of those originally, but them all came out. They worked out over the years. So I got those records in there. So then they gave me 100%. And they gave me $85,000 for back pay. And I've had that ever since. But they've always treated me good at the hospital anyway. Mm-hmm. I've had good... The first doctor I had, he quit and went to work for himself. And then this young lady just gone through all her training, and she was a registered doctor now. She took over, and I've had her for, I don't know, 20, 25 years now. She got married, and she's got a daughter that's going to college now. And they've treated me good.
That's good.
Can't complain. Now, other than the hell I went through, you can't talk to people about it. Nobody believes it, mm-hmm. you know. But I have talked to... Well, I was having this problem. I forget to tell this. While I was having this problem in the 90s, I having these operation things going, and I joined this POW group that the hospital had, and we keep talking, and I started having nightmares. All I could see was that damn big tank coming for me. So I was in the doctor's office one day waiting for the doctor, and this blonde kid came in and sat in a chair waiting for. I don't know what he was waiting for, don't even know what. But I started to bawl. I never broke down and bawled in my life. I bawled and I bawled and I bawled. And the doctor finally come to me and she says, Mr. Grace, what's the matter? I said, I don't know. I says, that young fellow over there with the blonde hair come in, and I just tried to bawl. So, she said, let's go up to the psychiatric. I don't want no psychiatric. She said, well, there's a nice young girl up there to talk to you. So I went up and she put one of these things down and she started asking me my life from my training till I got to England and when I was fighting. And it took her 2 or 3 days with this thing. And finally, we was out fighting now. And we was in a little town, and me and my buddy was going down the street. He's a BAR man, and I got just an M1 rifle. And what you're doing when you're street fighting, you're shooting at all those windows to keep people, because they was leaving these kids behind, old men to snipe at us. The army had gone. So we used to have to go down the street, and then we'd throw a hand grenade in a cellar or in a room to clear it. Well, my buddy got shot right through the heart. He had the BAR. And of course our rule was, anybody see that BAR, you pick it up, you use it. Because you need a BAR, because you know what they are?
They're fully automatic.
Yeah, well, it's an automatic rifle. And it's heavy. I don't remember how heavy, but I was only about 140 pounds in those days, and it was heavy. So I went to see, make sure he was dead, took his helmet, stuck my rifle in the ground, and put his helmet on it, and started to go away. And I hadn't gone 10 or 12 steps, and this blonde guy came out of the room with his hand up, and I hit the BAR, and I went like that, stitched him from the bottom, and kept on going, because I was fighting, there was dead guys all around. I never thought of it again in my life. But that kid struck something in my brain, apparently, and it came right to me when this woman's talking about street fighting. That's how bad things get. So anyway, I've done pretty good. I've had good health. I've had a few operations, but nothing's too serious. Gallbladder was the worst. But they take good care of me, and they found out 10 years ago that I was subject to diabetes. So I'm taking little pills now.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Got them here somewhere. There, right there. I take 2 at night and 2 in the morning. And they keep it under control, so everything's good. I have to protect and check myself every day. And I could tell a lot of things, but it's I can't say it, you know. I break down, I'm afraid of it. But I went through hell, I'll tell you. And not only me, all my other buddies. The first battles we had, we lost 537 men. According to the records. I move too fast, I can't see what I'm doing. This is where we fought in Holland. River crossing was the worst.
The river crossing, was that at the Rhine River? The river crossing, was that at the Rhine?
No, the river crossing I fought across was in Holland here.
Okay.
Alright, we was there not quite a month. There were 673 killed just in this regiment. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a squad in those days of 12 men. We never had more than seven. Mostly wounded, but killed too. A lot of guys would freeze their feet and have to go back, or sick, or diarrhea, because we used to spend nights in a foxhole. We'd fight during the day from early morning, dark. We started always in the dark. This guy here made us work and fight at night. We'd start at dark and attack and take over these towns. We'd flank them and take them, street fight and all that. And then the afternoon we'd dig a foxhole out in the field because they'd go counterattack us. Every day they counterattack. And when they counterattack, you'd get in your foxhole with your buddy, and you'd hunch down, and you'd let them come through. Sometimes they'd come right through, shooting automatic thing all around. But the best thing would do to let them do it. Because after they get by us, they get to the first line of defense was behind us. And they'd mow them down, or they'd drive them back. But anyway, all this time they'd be shelled. They'd shell us every day. And I mean, a man don't know what he's gone through until he's set in a foxhole with 60 explosions going off every minute. You don't do much but cry and pray. And I could say only one thing. God, please help me. I want to get home to my wife and kids. It's the same thing every day. But as I say, that guy was on my shoulder, I know today, because I've had the same experience since then of them helping me. He helped me all during my job. I was a kid out of high school, and I ended up with in those days now, $50,000 a year plus $25,000 expense account.
That's pretty good. I know, I'd probably kill for that right now.
Yeah, but I started out at $10 a week. Back in 38, it was $10 a week. 39, they gave me 12. 40, they gave me 14. My wife, I got married. They gave me $14 a week. And then it kept going, and when I got drafted, I was up to $25 a week. When I come back, the first paycheck was $75 a week. And then it kept going right up.
When you were actually started fighting, not as just as a replacement and everything like that, how long did you fight before you were captured?
Do you know, 28 days, I think it was.
Really?
Yeah. We was in the front for 28 days without relief. We was going to get relief that day. It was Thanksgiving Day. The boys here that was in the back of the company, like the modem and everything, they had Thanksgiving dinner. But we didn't. Because if you read what they found out what was happening. K, here's one guy's what happened that day. Stadio. You got that thing still going?
Yep, it's still rolling.
Okay. Now, all this, of course, I didn't know any of this until 60 years later. 1994, I got any of that.
And who wrote this exactly? Do you know? Who wrote this?
What'd you say?
Who wrote this?
That guy was a mortar man. He was behind. He remembers it from that. Now I've read that, and knowing where I can vary that quite a bit. What I was there. And in here, the record is again, but it's a little different than I know.
Yeah.
They told it different than I know what it was, especially the date. Mud knee deep, I agree with that. Supply of hand grenades were soon exhausted, yep. Three officers were killed in our company. Now here's where they made a mistake. Company initially took 100 prisoners. We didn't. It was Company I took them prisoners. And they marched us through us, though, back. And then the guys that was marching them back got killed and the prisoners disappeared. So that's where that's wrong. And the same is over here. It said Company I reached Hill 272. It was Company L that reached 272. Company I was off to the left. So whoever wrote this didn't get it exactly right.
Yeah.
But basically, yes. That's the way things go. And there's the report when I got my disability when they found the shrapnel and things. Now that is, what is the date up there?
No
date there, no, probably. Sir. But that's
1992 is what it says, March, yeah. March 30th.
It's a long way after that all happened.
That's 50
Meanwhile,
years.
I'd gone to my doctor when I had this knee trouble, because I didn't know about the shrapnel. But when I got blown up and when I was hurting, And I was out of it. I actually really out of it most of my POW days. I'd faint in and out. And when I get over it, I don't remember coming home. All I remember is they put me on an airplane. I don't remember where we landed, but they tell me it was in France. I don't remember getting on a ship. I don't remember getting off the ship, but I remember standing there, though, with this tanker on my... That's all I remember.
Did they ever find out what that was from?
Well, it must have been shrapnel.
Shrapnel or something like that?
Yeah, because it got a big dent there.
Yeah.
Got a big dent. And I showed them there at the thing, you could have done that anyway. Yeah. Couldn't prove anything, you know. But
How did they end up proving everything to get your medals and stuff? How did they prove everything to get your medals and stuff?
Well, they wrote to I got
that. Those are my questions there. That one I give that to right here.
I'm going to give you all that stuff. You take it, just keep it, or throw it away. I don't care. I copied it. So
okay.
I'll give it to you. Let me see. I was going to do something. Oh. The DAV wrote to the records place where it was. And you let me get up. You get over there a minute and I'll show you.
Got it?
Yeah. I can't walk so good, but I got a cart they gave me. I go around by a cart. There it is. That's what the stuff came in when they sent to me. And there's the letters. There's a letter telling me what I had for all those medals.
Mm-hmm. How many medals did you end up receiving?
I had 8, I think.
Yeah.
But at the time, all they gave me was this and this. Mm-hmm. Until I got this in the mail. And then I went and I had to buy the rest of them. Mm-hmm. See, here's the 96 is when I got that. 96, yep.
Wow. So you got this...
Huh?
What is that? You got this 51 years after the war?
After the war was over.
Jeez.
And of course, I didn't worry about it because I told you, never talked about the war until I got going to post, going to pieces. And then when the... When the chaplain at the VA, I knew him before I knew him at the VA. When I moved here, my son and I got we built a house and I moved there, and all the friends were going to a Universalist church, which was at the villages over there. Mm-hmm. Then they didn't have a place, but they decided they'd build one. So I volunteered to go help them as a supervisor. Mm-hmm. And doing electrical work, because when I was a kid, that's what I learned, electric. So anyway, then that's when I get to find Glenn Busby, which is the chaplain, one of the chaplains at the VA. And he's the one that started all this stuff that's...
All the research and stuff for you?
Yeah, all those... Plaques I put, and there's a big plaque over there. Mm-hmm. That I can't put it up, it's too big to go on the wall. They gave it to me when they tore the part of the building down while they're building the new hospital out there. So we gave it to me to keep. And when they get done, they're going to put our pictures, our story, on the walls in the new place.
That's really cool.
So that's when I got to know him. And so since then, he's worked with me day after day, taking all this stuff down. And that story that you started, you didn't start to read the story in here, but this story in here, it tells you pretty near what I just told you.
Here are your pictures. Do you want to hang on to those?
Yeah, you can have them. Yeah. See, this story in here starts here and here and here, then skips over and starts again here, explaining all this stuff.
What we can do with this stuff is what I'll do with this. All this stuff you're giving me here, which is very nice of you. Thank you very much.
I've got duplicates, so
we're gonna take those and we'll put them with the transcript and everything in the archives. Yeah, so there's actually other, which is nice because there's other citations and stuff like that of the information that you give us, which is awesome.
Because there's all this stuff I can't prove it.
Yeah,
I can't prove it. All the buttons. And I'll tell you, buddies turned over so fast, I don't remember half the buddies that I did know, but I only knew them for a few days. I see, I was only actually frontline fighting for 28 days. All that Belgian stuff, I wasn't actually up front. I was in the reserve. I didn't get to fight until we got to Germany, really. Then I got shot at every day. Before that, though, I used to get, even when I come across Omaha Beach, 2 months after the war was after they landed, the Germans are still bombing that and artillery's coming in on it. And me and the guys that was with me, here's another funny thing. When they left England, there was 50 of us. They put us on an LST. And they gave me the records of everybody. And they said, when you get it over there, you give that to the man on the beach that's in charge. So I got it. They took us, they dropped us off in the water up to our waist from the boat. They didn't land us on shore. Couldn't, it was all stove up. Because after the fight, they fixed part of it and they had it off. And then this big storm come, wiped it all out. So we had to wade ashore. Then we went up and we each had a half a pup tent, you know what they are. We had to put them again to sleep up on top of the thing. Mm-hmm. And
the barriers and stuff like that in the water?
No, on the land. They pop up.
The mines?
Mines. That's what I wanted. They're all around. And they had lines of tape showing safe place to throw them. So we was there for a month and a half. And I tried to give this to a guy, and he wouldn't take it. The guy that other thing. He says, you got to wait for an Army guy to come. He was a Navy guy. So I hung on to it. And he says, meanwhile, we want you to work here with us. We're loading trucks with gasoline for the guys up going toward. They were trying to take St. Lo that time, but they hadn't taken it yet. But we was loading ammunition, gas, food on the trucks at the beach. And then finally, a guy come looking for us. And then he made us march 25 or 30 miles from there over to where that land and this division had landed. What a deal. Everything was so fouled up. Everything. Like the day that we got wiped out. It was a foul up. The damn artillery, they'd done that twice before. Supposed to walk ahead of us. Started behind us and run over us. That happened to us twice. I went out on a night patrol one night. There was an artillery piece that the Germans had across this little piece, like a brook, and kept giving us a fit. So the captain called us in one night. He said, I want three volunteers to go over after dark and see if you can find out where that is. So me and two other guys took off. You don't take your rifle with you. All we had was a knife, bayonet knife, and not much. A couple hand grenades. So we went across. We did. We found it. Made some notes. And we started back, and it was so dark we got lost. And so we come back into a area that was not ours. And they didn't know who we were. They could see us, so they called our own artillery to fire at us. So we're out in the middle of this field, and the first shot come over, and I said, oh, they're shooting at us. I saw shooting at us. So I tried to scrape a slip chinch and roll into it. And they bracketed us with three shells, but they didn't hit us. So we laid there a while, then we finally got up and started yelling. And they finally recognized we was Americans, they let us in. But we was out of our way probably quarter of a mile from where we should have been. So we found the gun. The next day our artillery found it and cleaned it out. See, what happened was, when you're fighting like that, you come to a post, a building that you can't get into, or it's too tough. You need help. We didn't have tanks, but we did have artillery, and we had mortar guys. And we usually had an artillery lieutenant with us with a wire cable, and he'd call back, tell them to bombard it. That's how we operated in my day. Mm-hmm. One night we got in this town and we got surrounded. So we get down in this cellar, and we could look out. And these tanks, German tanks, come all around us. They stopped, and they smoked and bivouac, and we're down here quiet in the cellar. But we had that, we had the guy with the wire with us. So he called back and told him where we were. And the artillery sent over air bursts that burst in the air. Hey, they wiped those guys right out. We're all safe in the cellar. Then the next morning we get out and get back, because we'd gone so far ahead, we got cut off. We had to get back to our own lines. That happens quite a few times. Get cut off. Yeah, if you read those stories,
mm-hmm. I'll take this.
If you had this to read, boy, you'd know what war's about, I'll tell you. And I didn't know all these stories until, like, I don't know, late 90s before I got these.
Mm-hmm.
How I got them was I was in the DAV again. I joined it. And they come one day and said, there's a I got the history of the whole outfit over there, a book of the whole outfit. But I wasn't only interested in what my little part was, and that's what this part. And I didn't get that until, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Jeez.
Now, you're a young fella. You're going to college there?
Yes, sir. I go to University of Florida. Yeah. I'm actually a history major there.
Uh-huh.
So, which is how I got involved with this program and everything like that, and just love it, so...
I had heard about this from my boy at the VA.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we get this every 6 months. And this is the last letter because every year they've had a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And this year is the last meeting. They tell them about it. We paid dues, now we don't have to pay dues anymore. But there's a story here.
Mm-hmm.
Of the guy that had one of the towns in Belgium that we liberated. And he's quite a story. I remember the first town we liberated in Belgium.
Uh-huh.
I had a beard for me then, and I hadn't had a bath for a month, and I had need a haircut, and this old man, I was walking down the street, we wasn't fighting then. And I was walking down the street, and he come out and he said, boy, he said, I'll give you a shave and a haircut. I says, you will? He said, yes, sir. He took me in and gave me a shave and a haircut. And his wife and the kids was out giving everybody milk and eggs, and they was feeding everybody. They was happy that we came, I'll tell you. And that's that guy there.
That's cool.
I was talking about in that story. He came over here to the last meeting they had. How proud they was of us and how happy they was that we came there and liberated them.
Oh, this guy was in the town? Was from the town? Or was he in the army?
Who is that? No, that's the guy from...
Oh, this one here.
Yeah, that's this guy.
Matthew Maher.
Yeah. There he is. No, there he is right there.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one that went over and meet this guy. And then this guy come over here.
Well, that's cool.
You could take that if you want to. If you'd copy it and get me back. I don't want to lose it, though.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. I'll leave this with you. Because we have... there's some things there that... Normally takes about forever and a day to get something copied at the program, so. But Mr. Graves, is there anything else you want to add to the recording? Any other experiences or anything like that?
All I want to add is I'm thankful that they're taking care of me. They do a good job. That VA Gainesville boy does a good job. Anything I need now, I've had trouble here, and they give me these. I've had 4 sets of here. And they aren't very good. You and I talking here, I can hear.
Mm-hmm.
I can half understand you, not all. But it's so bad. And I was in there the other day, and I met Dr. Yankee's name is, which is the head of this department, and I hadn't been there for about 4 years. And I kept complaining. I said, Doc, I says, isn't there something better than these things you've been giving me in the past? He says, I'm glad you asked. He says, yes, there is. He says, now I want you to come back next week and we're going to examine you all over again. We're going to get you some new ones now that they're selling for $3,000 down the street. But the new ones, they don't sweat your ear. They put it behind your ear and they put a wire in your ear. So they've ordered them for me. He said, take a couple months before I get them. They take impression and everything.
That's cool.
So, but they're like that. And when I was in the hospital with my gallbladder, I was only in there 3-4 days, but I went through quick. I want to go home. Because I had a wife then. I was married for 64 years. My wife died in 04. And I was home with her. But she'd go shopping. I couldn't go because I couldn't walk very far. I have to sit down. So when I was in the hospital, the DAV man come talk to me again. He said, what's your problem? I said, well, nothing except I can't do anything anymore. I can't walk only 100 feet, so then I got to sit down. Oh, he says, didn't he give you a scooter yet? I said, no, I don't know anything about scooters. He says, well, they furnish them here. I said, oh. He says, I'll see that you get one. A couple months later, I got a letter to come in and pick out my scooter. So for the last 8 years, I guess, I wore out the first one. I got the second one.
Too many miles on it, huh?
I use them a lot. I go to the mall, and I don't have anything to do with them. My son and his wife, they take good care of me, but, you know, I guess sit in this room most every day and watch that stupid thing up there. I forgot to turn it off, even.
Oh, that's fine. Wouldn't bother us.
I had the sound off. I have to listen to it with that. With that, I hear good.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then they got me special shoes, so they won't, because they swell up. That's why I got them off. My feet swell up if I leave them on too long. But I can walk from here out to my car, and I still drive my car.
Thank you.
They won't let me drive it very far, because they're afraid I'll go out, but I could. I used to drive it up to 2 years ago, I used to drive it to, I got a daughter up in Raleigh, North Carolina. I used to drive it up there every other month. Because I got 3, 6, 7 great-great-grandchildren up there.
Jeez.
I got lots of them. And I did a lot of fishing in the old days, too.
Yeah, I see that.
I had a couple of my grandchild there. That's 20 years ago, 25 years ago. There was a big striped bass.
Yeah.
And I got I've caught sailfish. I had them in my office, but I couldn't bring them down here. But I brought that, since I've been down here, I got that. And I've had big boats. I had big motorhomes. That's the biggest one I had there. Yeah. It's a Mountaineer motorhome. $150,000. I lived in that. My wife and I lived in that. After she got sick, we sold our home. And we went with that. I went to North Carolina with my daughter. We was going to Alaska. Got all the papers and everything. Headed out. We get up there and she got sick. She says, I want to go home. So we come back home. Because at that time, I lived over at Ocala on top of the world, Ocala, nice place. But she got so bad, and then she started having a little Alzheimer's problem. So I says, darling, what we're going to do, because years ago we had a motorhome.
Yeah.
That's back in the 80s. And I said, let's go now and buy us a new one. Let's sell our house, buy us, and we'll go to Alaska. So we started, but as far as we got was North Carolina. and I'd come back here, and I'd build a place out here to park it with sewer and water and everything, electric. And then my wife got colon cancer. 9 weeks, she never suffered, but she died. So then my son took me and brought me in here. And then I finally sold it, because I still owed $85,000 on it.
Yeah. Those are a trip. We got one back home. We got one back home. Mom wanted it. And she's like, I want to go camping. We haven't been, she hadn't been out camping in it anyway. We take it out where we hunt about 2 hours south of here. And we have a camp that we lease every year. And we just put it out there. And that's where it sits from end October to January.
Yeah. So, because I come from Maine. Mm-hmm. Always hunted and fished.
Mm-hmm. Same here.
And me and my buddy used to go hunting early in the fall. And you could shoot bear in those days, mm-hmm. and we'd shoot 4 or 5 bear, and not shoot them. We'd trap them, put them in a friend of ours at a walk-in freezer. Then we'd sell them to the guys coming up from New York, Massachusetts in the fall. We'd sell them to them. And I used to fish a lot, and I used to have a big 35-foot cruiser with twin screws in those days, because mm-hmm. I was well off in those days mm-hmm. compared to most people. Had plenty of money. Lived a good life. I can't complain at all. I had two of the most wonderful Jewish people I worked for. They taught me everything, and he was when the war started, he went into the army as a fly-in instructor, because he had his own plane. So he went in World War II as an instructor. Then when the Korean War come, he went to Korea and started in with helicopters. And then when that got over, Eisenhower put him in $1 a year, and they sent him to Africa to set up all those separate towns that the Germans owned, those counties down there. Mm-hmm. He spent 2 years in Africa. And I'm his secretary back here in Maine, taking care of everything. And then he went to Italy and trained all the Israeli guys that fought in the 67 war. Then he came back home. He had pancreas cancer. And about 10 years and he was dead. That's my original boss. Then his brother was in another part of town in Maine over in Lewiston, and he's the one that made me go over there when I come back. But here I'm just a kid out of high school. I didn't have any training in anything, but I could think. And I learned the business from the bottom up. And I learned we had all these contractors we sold to wholesale. But three stores we had was like Home Depot. We had everything except lumber. We never had lumber, but we had everything. I learned all that business. I went to New York and Chicago and Atlanta buying trips for these stores. I did all the buying for 6 outlets, which about, between all of us, we had $7 million worth of inventory. In those days, that was a lot. And I had 28 men on the road. And altogether, I had 300 employees and 6 outlets. And I built all 3 of them, 4 of them. I built 4 of them.
And what was the store exactly? What was it? What kind of store was it? What kind of store was it?
Like Home Depot.
Oh, it was like Home Depot?
Oh, and bigger on the wholesale part.
Okay.
Plumbing, heating, electrical. We was the first ones in Maine to have a showroom where you could go buy a bathroom set. Before that, you only could get them sitting in a catalog. Nobody showed them. Mm-hmm. But we made a big place and had displays right on the floor. Light fixtures, you know, well, like you go there today, yeah. Like that. Only not quite so big, but the same idea. We had everything. And we had all the contractors, plumbing, heating, electrical, air conditioning. I probably had 300 contractors buying from me. Mm-hmm. And my biggest ones was the pulp and paper industry. I'd sell $1 million stock to them 1 year time. It was a good business, but I learned it all from scratch with that help up there. Mm-hmm. We all did, even my bosses learned it from scratch. We learned it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you gotta have all these degrees to get everything.
Can't do that today.
Nope.
Plus, we worked for 42 years. Now, I got people working for me, that work for me. I only know three of them are alive today, because they was young then. I used to hire my guys. I'd hire them from high school. Because during their summer vacation, they used to come work part-time in my retail stores. So I'd get to know them, and then I'd hire them and put them in a position and learn them how to be an electrical salesman or a plumbing salesman or a heating salesman or whatever. Mm-hmm.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. All right, Mr. Graves, I do thank you for your time. We do appreciate it. Thank you for your time. We do appreciate the interview. What we can do is we'll get right on this once we get it back. It'll be a few weeks or so, and we'll have an audio of this recording here and a transcript that'll be following up. And we'll send that directly to you because we do have your address and everything like that. So, and you're probably going to get some mail from the Library of Congress. I'm not too sure, but you may get mail from them too.
Say again?
You may get mail from the Library of Congress too.
Whatever. So,
But I do thank you for your time.